Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be talking about a really cool Irish pilot study that looks at epileptic seizures and whether or not they give off a scent. It involves electric noses and dogs and spinning around. It's a crazy story, which you'll love, I'm sure. First, though, if you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of those comments at the end. And if you're listening to this in advance of the 14th of May and live around the Cork area, you might know that I am trying to raise the AI literacy of the country with Get Started With AI. If you want to improve how you do in your role and your business, find out more at getstartedai.com. We're running a boot camp on the 14th of May in Cork. Right, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and we're joined by Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and from RCSI Professor Annie Curtis. Our first story, Annie, has to do with sleep.
It does, Jonathan, and it has to do with not needing much sleep. So the story is about they found a mutation that's linked to thriving with little rest. A genetic mutation linked to being able to thrive with very little sleep, basically. So we all know them, those individuals who can get by on 6 hours sleep.
Yeah. I think Bobby Kerr is one of them.
Luke O'Neill is one of them.
Yeah.
Yep.
Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, well, but she got Alzheimer's in the end. So I think she used to nap a lot during the afternoon. So
she cheated.
So I think she cheated. But these folks are called natural short sleepers, and they can sleep, you know, between 3 and 6 hours a night without any negative effects. Not to be confused.
Says who now? Who says there's no negative effects?
Well, biologically, they are able to do all the processes that we need, say, 7 or 8 hours sleep. They can do those in like 3 to 6 hours.
But I guess what I'm asking is, what if they had 8 hours sleep? Would they be able to do so much more?
No. Funnily enough.
Sorry, I'm jumping ahead. I'll let you tell the story.
You are jumping ahead, Jonathan. Sorry. So, no, these natural short sleepers, or NSS, they actually feel worse when they sleep more.
Huh.
So once they're able to do, so like sleep is needed for, I love sleep, Jonathan, I'm a big sleep fan. Detox, repair and reset. And these natural short sleepers are able to do that in a shorter time. So whereas it might take us 7 hours to do all those processes, it'll take these people like 4 or 5 hours. And I am jealous. And so up to now, we have discovered a number of genes that that allow people to have this kind of phenotype. So one of the first genes that was discovered was back in the noughties, and the gene is called DEC2, and it's a circadian rhythm gene. So that really makes sense.
That's your interest.
And that is my absolute love.
Because when you said, you know I love sleep, I was wondering, do listeners know how I know that she loves sleep? There's an implication there. It's because she studies circadian rhythms and nothing else.
Jonathan.
I thought you just liked to stay in bed.
Yeah. I study circadian rhythms. That's what I do. But this last gene that they're after finding is called SIK6, which is an enzyme. And an enzyme is a protein that does loads of things. That's how I teach it to the undergrads. And basically this protein, this enzyme, sits in the space between neurons. And the space between neurons is called synapses. And what they did was they made the mutation in a mouse, and they could see that that mouse only needed 30 minutes less sleep a night, which is fairly big, because a mouse probably only sleeps like, same as us, maybe nine hours. And so it just shows that it you know, by identifying these mutations, what it's really doing is it's allowing us, it's kind of lifting the cover on how sleep works, and it allows us to kind of identify new therapeutic targets for insomnia or even interventions for insomnia. Mm. And you are not in any way convinced by the look of it.
No, I am. I'm just wondering, would I want a mutation that meant I didn't need to sleep so much? I mean, my brain goes 90 when I'm awake. I kind of think
you need this. It
would bonk out. I think it would bonk out. Very interesting.
Is grumpiness one of the scales of how effective sleep is? Because when I don't sleep, my wife tells me you're being a bit of a grump. And
your man Portillo did a show where he was he wanted to see how sleep affected young parents and how it, and he did a show where he stayed up for 24 hours or 48 hours or something. And he was like, he described it really well. He was like, oh my God, I want to kill everyone.
It's
very difficult.
Sleep deprivation is a form of torture.
Our second story, Shane, has to do with measles, which, you know, you'd kind of think that on this programme we'd never need to talk about measles, but yet here we
Trump.
Are.
Well, measles, in the year 2000, the United States had said it had eliminated measles, which meant over a 12-month period there was no sustained transmission. And this is all due to a vaccine. And it is the most effective treatment of measles is just not to get it. Measles is a devastating disease. When Europeans went to the New World in the early modern period, they passed on diseases, measles being one of them, that wiped out 95% of the native population. So these things are devastating, and measles is up there perhaps as one of the most contagious diseases that's out there. And we're seeing in the United States at the moment an outbreak in the American Southwest, in Mexico and in Canada. And the director of vaccine education at the Center at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, a professor called Paul Offit, has said effectively we are now starting to see post-herd immunity. And he said measles is going to be the first of many diseases that we'll see this occur for because it is so contagious. So it's quite worrying, and it's really worrying because it's not due to science, it's due to human behaviour.
Yeah. What's kind of crazy is that the fact that we created a vaccine and that we made everybody for decades and decades and take the vaccine at birth, that would tell you this is a kind of important disease to not have. I mean, if the MMR, right, that first vaccine that you get as a, or maybe it's the second, I can't remember, vaccine that you get as a child, that every child in the developed world gets, you kind of think, yeah, well, there's probably a good reason for that.
Yeah,
absolutely. And yet, because we don't see measles in the wild anymore, people think, oh, it's not something to worry about. It's actually mind-boggling, the reverse obviousness of this.
Like, when I talk to students about this in the module on trust and science, we look at the famous Wakefield paper and how it took 11 years for the journal to not just say we won't stand over it, but we'll retract it.
Yeah.
11 years. And over that time, even though it would be debunked, certain media sources continue to present it as if it was credible evidence to
link autism.
We call it epistemic doubt, right? So or basically what happens is that when you go to the doctor, you don't know effectively enough about the science to make a decision yourself. So it's called testimonial knowledge. You know because they've told you. And if you trust the doctor, you trust the science.
Hmm.
But if somebody else comes in and starts to sow doubt, either deliberately or not deliberately, now you have two opposing issues. And when you think about jabbing your young child with a needle, and I hate when they show pictures in the newspapers of vaccines because they always show needles, never a sick child. I don't know why they show children who actually have measles. And people are understandably fearful, some communities more so than others, because they have been on the wrong end of bad actors in science in the past. And as a result of it, unless we have over 95% of people immunized, it's still out there. And so that what happens is if a child under the age of 5 encounters measles and they haven't been vaccinated yet, the based on current statistics, 1 in 3 of them will end up in hospital, which shows how serious it is.
Yeah.
And now that we have somebody in the United States as the health secretary who is, quote, an anti-vaccine activist, effectively he's asking for clinical trials to be rerun, which is unethical, looking for to slow down the NIH trials for universal influenza trials. So really putting the brakes on by disinformation, removing core infrastructure, and crucially removing people with expertise from places like where Annie works. So you're now 11 times more likely in the US to get measles since 2024, 10 times more likely in Europe. 87% of the cases are in Romania. Only Hungary, Malta and Portugal have effective herd immunity, i.e. 95% of people have had two doses of the measles vaccine.
We have herd immunity though in Ireland, do we?
No, not according to the paper I read, which is concerning. I would have thought we did.
Yeah.
If you want to hear more about this, Shane has done an excellent podcast. It's called The Trust Race. You can find it wherever you find your podcast. It's not as good as this show, but it's very, very good.
Thank you. Second best.
Annie, what a stupid thing to say. Sorry. I apologize. Shane, Annie, our third story has to do with an unusual surgery, which I thought this is absolutely fascinating.
It is, absolutely. So this is a medical first. So basically, surgeons have been able to remove a tumour through a patient's eye. So it wasn't a paper as such, it was actually just a story in the Washington Post. And it was about, the patient was, is 19-year-old Carla Flores. She had been facing a number of brain surgeries. So she had had two brain surgeries at the University of Maryland Medical Center. And these were rare tumors the size of a chicken egg, right?
God.
And they were removed from her brain. But she also had this other type of tumor, which is called a chordoma, which is a very rare tumor. Only about 300 of these are diagnosed a year in the US. And this was actually like strangling Flores's spinal cord, like near the base of her skull. So the issue was, and it was pressing against a nerve responsible for eye movement. So actually the reason that they knew there was something wrong is her eye actually started to turn in, you know, towards her nose. And so they thought that they might be able to remove the tumor through her left eye socket. But the problem was, like, if they were even millimetres off, she could lose all movement below the neck and suffer a fatal brain stem stroke. But as I said, if it worked, and we are talking about it, the only reason we're talking about it because it did work, is it would be a new option for surgeons, right? So I just thought it was interesting. If you look at a tumour like this, basically they had four options, okay? So they could go through the back of Flores' neck, right?
Now, why wouldn't they do that?
Because it was obstructed. It wasn't like underneath all the muscles and stuff like that. It wasn't it wasn't in plain sight, let's
right.
say. They could enter through the front, through her mouth, right? But they didn't want to do that because your mouth is full of bacteria.
Oh.
So if you do a surgery like that, you're likely to cause infection
right.
in the tumour. They could go through the nostril, but this was going to provide limited view, or you could go through the lower eye socket. And what they...
Do they pull the eye out and let it sit like a floppy doppy on the cheek?
Yeah, they kind of release everything and they cut through the bone of the eye socket and the jaw, right?
Jeez.
The surgeon, he dubbed this the third nostril. And so it's never been done. So it was 19 hours of surgery to get this done. They ended up taking some bone for her hip and reconstructing her eye socket and her jaw. But it was hugely successful. She's been given a full bill of health. 1 year later, it still hurts her. Her neck still hurts her. And she still has to wear like kind of a collar. But other than that, she's doing very well.
Oh, that's great to hear. Incredible surgery. And just the creativity of thinking about doing that. Our final story has to do with reading scrolls that can't be read.
Yeah, and I learned a new word, papyrologist, a person who studies these things, somebody called Michael MacOscar in UCL. They were looking at a Vesuvian scroll written in the first century wrapped up and completely turned to like almost carbonized entirely, so they weren't able to unravel it. And they put it in a very high power X-ray source called the Diamond X-ray source in the United Kingdom, and using it and a combination of clever kind of digital unwrapping, they have been able to read what's on the scroll. And they know now that it's most likely the first part of a multi-volume work called On Vices by the Epicurean philosopher Philodemus. And of course, Epicurean, as my wife tells me, is about good taste, culture and enjoying life. So hopefully there it's a bit of a page turner or a scroll unraveler for us to read over the summer. And this is the first of 18 scrolls that has been probed by the X-ray in Diamond. And now all the humans have to get to work, the social scientists and the people from the humanities, to try and figure out what it actually says and means.
When with this X-ray, what are they picking up in the X-ray? Is there a particular
ink
element? It's ink.
Ink.
And what is the ink made of?
Actually, I don't know. I just assumed it was the ink. But I'm now realising that ink today is probably quite different to ink in the past. But I assume it was some
Lapis lazuli. Is that what they used to bring the...
Yeah, maybe. But like they're able to distinguish it from the paper, basically. So, the thing we call paper now is quite different, but whatever they were writing on. So
they use some sort of AI algorithm to unwrap.
Yes, exactly. AI is incredibly important here. As they start to pull it apart, they have to be able to distinguish one letter from the other. And it's really cool. I think these ancient from the first century writings from a ancient Roman villa on the side of Herculaneum that was then covered in 79 AD by the famous Vesuvian eruption. And found, of course, in a Roman villa that is thought to have been related to Julius Caesar.
Like, wow. And crazy that guy has no idea that we're talking about this, having read it 2,000 years later at the bottom of a volcano. Thank you so much, Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and from RCSI, Professor Annie Curtis. Now, you may think you know what an epileptic seizure looks like, but do you know what it smells like? My next guest is investigating the possibility of training dogs to predict seizures using AI. Her name is Dr. Shelley Brady. She's a postdoctoral researcher at the Insight Centre for Data Analytics at DCU. Welcome to the programme, Shelley. Great to have you on. Let's start off with the basic stuff, right? And what is an epileptic seizure and what causes it?
Okay, well, thanks, first of all, for having me on the show. It's great to be able to be here and talk about the project. So during an epileptic seizure, there's a sudden surge of abnormal electrical activity in the brain, and this disrupts normal function and it can cause a variety of symptoms. So these symptoms can include muscle movements, changes in awareness, alterations in sensations, and the specific symptoms depend on where the seizure originates in the brain and the type of seizure.
When you say, do all seizures look very similar? Like, would I be able to, I mean, obviously you probably would be able to tell what an epileptic seizure is as opposed to, because there are other types of seizures that have nothing to do with epilepsy, correct?
Absolutely, there are. So you've got your generalized onset seizures, and this is where the abnormal electrical activity would affect both sides of the person's brain. Mm-hmm. And in these seizures, they may lose consciousness. Sometimes it's so brief that no one might notice. So these are what we refer to as absences. So they'd be staring spells that last only seconds, but consciousness is lost briefly.
Right.
And then you've got things like tonic-clonic seizures, where there is a loss of consciousness and there are convulsive movements of the limbs. And this would be the type of seizure that most people would think of when they think of epilepsy, where the body stiffens and the limbs would move and jerk.
Right. Yeah. I have been in the presence of a friend of mine who has epilepsy, and when she's had a seizure, it's a very frightening thing.
Absolutely.
And I've also been in the presence of my son who banged his head, and it sounded like he had one of the sort of mini seizures that you spoke about. These things happen very using the N as one, as me being the only example. Like, these things happen frequently enough. How dangerous are epileptic seizures to those who endure them?
So I suppose seizures vary greatly between people. And one of the most, I suppose, the primary concerns for individuals with epilepsy is that risk associated with seizures occurring without warning. Mm. So that could potentially lead to dangerous situations or injuries as a result of falling or hitting their heads, for example. And sadly, there are more than 130 epilepsy-related deaths occurring annually in Ireland. And this includes cases of sudden unexpected death in epilepsy. In Ireland, epilepsy actually affects over 45,000 people, which is roughly one in every 100 people. So that means the chances of you knowing someone or knowing of someone with epilepsy in Ireland is quite high.
Yeah, I want to get on to your research in a bit, but just to, because I have a lot of questions about epileptic seizures. The danger is mostly when the person experiencing the seizure is not, for example, lying down in safety. So people have these seizures, and a lot of the time they know when a seizure is coming on, because I've been in the presence of a friend of mine and she said I need to sit down. You know, there is an awareness of it. So let's talk about the run-up to a seizure, because that's of what's interest here, and particularly with regards to your research. What happens in the run-up to someone having a seizure, both externally and internally?
Okay, so well, I suppose in terms of controlled epilepsy, let's just start there. So you've got people who have epilepsy that is controlled via medication, which means they may have epilepsy but may not have active seizures. And then for others, you've got uncontrolled epilepsy, which, as I said, they can be sudden and disruptive to everyday life. Its incidence is bimodal in distribution. So the highest risk is in infants and older age groups, and females are slightly more likely to have seizures. So I suppose all of that is to say it's incredibly individual in its presentation, and it affects people very differently. And even to the amount and the different types of seizures that there are, from your generalized onset to your focal onset. So those that affect one part of the brain to those that affect both sides of the brain. But I suppose some people do experience what we'd call an aura, which can be a very subjective experience or a change in feeling or sensations or behavior. So it can be smells, tastes, change in vision. So maybe a flashing or tingling sensation, even feelings of deja vu and familiarity can be a warning that a more significant seizure is about to occur.
And so, so in the run up to it, some people have this sort of subjective feeling that something's going to happen. So that gives us the sign that there are things that happen in the run up to a seizure. And that's what you're really interested in, being able to predict these seizures better. And hopefully reduce the number of deaths in Ireland as a result. So talk to me a little bit about what you're focused on, because it's quite unusual.
It is. It's really exciting. And I think when Professor Alan Smeaton and Professor Thomas Ward were designing this research, it very much was exactly what you were saying was at the forefront of their minds. So looking at being able to detect the seizures before the actual clinical onset of the seizure. So everybody releases volatile organic compounds or VOCs, and that's through our breath, our sweat, our skin, or bodily fluids. And these VOCs create a unique chemical fingerprint for each of us. And that varies from person to person, and it's based on our health, diet, stress levels, genetics, lifestyle, all of that stuff. And there is precedent and research to suggest that there's this intriguing idea that assistance dogs can detect subtle scent changes that happen before an individual has a seizure. So there was research done and published in the Scientific Reports, and they were able to show that trained dogs were able to distinguish between the sweat samples collected during seizures and those taken during non-seizure periods. Hmm. There was more research done in Florida. And what they were able to do was show that dogs were able to recognize that seizure-associated scent in sweat samples. And that was up to 93.7% accurate in their detection of this. And not only that, more interestingly, again, was they were able to detect this scent before about 78% of seizures, which an average warning time of about 68 minutes. So they were able to give a 68-minute prior to the seizure warning to the individuals that they were going to have a seizure.
Wow. And this scent is specific to the run-up to an epileptic seizure. It's not that they're getting a higher temperature and so they sweat more. It's not a generic scent. This scent
That's interesting. That's what we don't exactly know that yet. And there is more research going on around that area within the Insight Centre as well. But I suppose what we're interested in is, does that scent indicate a seizure and can the dogs alert to that? And I think there was also research done up in Queen's University by Dr. Neil Powell, and he observed that untrained pet dogs were exhibiting behavioural changes. So they were looking for the attention of their owners by touching them and whining and barking when they were exposed to seizure associated odors. So these were untrained dogs. So if we think about what we could do then with trained assistance dogs to alert people to these smells, that potential is absolutely huge.
That's fantastic. And it's really exciting, I suppose, in a way that we might be able to find a biomarker through scent for an upcoming seizure. The practical application of that is, you know, not everyone can get a dog and not everyone wants a dog, but presumably there are sensors out there that can be attuned to specific chemical fingerprints. Are there that is the end goal to be able to create a sensor that basically goes, bzz, bzz, you need to sit down and put your head in a pillow?
Yeah, again, that's really interesting. And there is research out there to show that. So I know, again, in the United States, they actually are in the development stages of developing a sensor system which is capable of identifying those VOCs, exactly that. And it's called a silicone nose. And they're showing that it can detect key VOCs up to 22 minutes before the seizure. But I suppose what we're trying to do, as you say, not everybody can have a dog, but some people can. And I think the benefits of potentially having a dog, not only to alert to seizures, but also in enhancing quality of life, can be absolutely huge. So what we're looking to do is demonstrate the reliability and the effectiveness of the scent training with the dog's piece. But we're also marrying that with a little bit of technology. So we're lucky enough that we have the Irish Dogs for the Disabled. So they are a charity based down in Cork. Mm-hmm. And they are central to the whole effort of us training the dogs with the VOCs and that the alerting behaviour. And that is absolutely fantastic. But where the tech bit comes in is we have a fantastic researcher on our team called Halen Song, and he's working on the techie side of the project, where each dog is going to be wearing a special collar, which is equipped with a sensor that tracks movement. So the dog will be smelling the VOC. They will be exhibiting an alerting behavior. So, for example, spinning. And once that behavior is detected in real time by the sensor, which is worn on the collar of the dog, this streams the movement data in real time to the cloud. And then an algorithm, which has been trained using machine learning, picks up this in real time and sends a warning via the, or an alert via a mobile phone app to the person, their family or caregiver, which informs them of the imminent seizure, as well as the location of the individual. So this is allowing caregivers to respond swiftly.
How did you come up with that? That is so clever. I was saying, how do they do that? So you basically have the dog that can smell. We haven't got the smelling technology digitized yet. So instead, you're using the dog's nose, and when it smells it, it's been trained to like spin around in a specific circle. And then you've got some sort of gyroscope sensor on the dog collar, which we can sense. And then that sends a message to the phone of the owner. It's so clever.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's the brainchild of Professor Alan Smeaton, as I said before. In
He's a very smart man. I know Alan well. He's a, I consider him a friend and colleague. Can I ask, do you think it's going to work? How far on are you in this project?
So at the moment, we're at the stage where Halen is training the collar as such. So that machine learning piece. So the folks down in Dogs for the Disabled, the dogs are spinning with the collar on, and Halen is using all of that data to train that collar and make sure that it is alerting. And at the moment, it's looking really, really positive. It's looking fantastic. I suppose we're working with animals. That's always going to, well, potentially it's going to throw up stuff that we weren't expecting in research, but that's what research is all about. It's about coming across different scenarios and overcoming them. I would be very hopeful that it's going to work, but I suppose that's why we're doing it, to find out.
That's research.
You're
presumably using labs or something. You're using like dogs that are good at being trained. I have a mini schnauzer, and there's no way my dog would be able to alert anybody about anything.
Well, the experts, Dogs for the Disabled down in Cork, they are experts in training dogs. So, like I said, we're lucky that they're central to that piece of the research.
I mean, they could probably run a whole school on how to train dogs as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're really lucky that they're partners with us in this.
In terms of participation, are you looking for volunteers, or is the study currently closed in terms of, do you know who you're hoping to get? And will these volunteers, do they have a protocol? So if they have a seizure, do they take off their T-shirt? Are they wearing particular types of clothing that is, you know, that will can be thrown away or given for samples? Do they have to change how they go about their daily routine to accommodate this protocol?
Slightly. I mean, we're being as, you know, unobtrusive as possible. But we are recruiting them. We're lucky again that we are recruiting through Beaumont Hospital. So we're not actively looking for volunteers. But the way it will work is that we will be providing T-shirts to any of the individuals who are taking part in this research. And like that, once they have had a seizure, they will take the T-shirt off. They will bag it and they will freeze it. And then we will be able to transport those frozen T-shirts down to Dogs for Disabled for them to use as their scent training.
Yeah. Just wearing the T-shirt is enough. You don't have to, like, I always wonder when we talk about, you know, like scent, the scent of a person, like, are we shedding so much of this scent that just wearing it is enough, or would they have to, you know, scratch underneath their armpits or something?
No, well, I suppose, the way we're running this piece of research is that, yes, they just need to wear it. I suppose when somebody is having a seizure, the tendency would be that they're, when there's a lot of movement like that, that there will be enough sweat on the, or VOCs on the material for us to be able to use as scent detection,
That's a really clever project. The best of luck with it. Dr. Shelley Brady is a postdoctoral researcher at Insight and DCU. Thank you so much for your time, Shelley.
Thank you.
That is a really cool study, I think. It'd be really interesting to see whether or not they get good results out of it. As I say, my Roxy, our mini schnauzer, is the most adorable dog, but she's not a guard dog. She won't fetch a ball, and she certainly will not be spinning around alerting people that they're about to have an epileptic seizure. However, when my wife was feeling very unwell, and properly unwell, she would not leave her side in a really uncanny way, because normally she would never do that. She literally just sprawled on top of my wife while she was unwell. And she really sensed that something was wrong. And that was just a moment of, dogs are amazing. Dogs are absolutely amazing. Right. Let's have a look at your comments from last week. Someone says, what use is a colour that only five people can see? We were talking about Olo, this pigment that was, it's not a pigment, it's a weird way of technically making a light visible to the human eye that's not possible other ways. And they used a very technical setup to do it. I don't know what the point of the colour is. I should have asked that question. That's a super question to ask. Like, why make a colour that only five people can see? I guess it's new technologies, new frontiers. And with basic research, right? We've talked about this a lot in the programme. Well, because basic research is, you know, is really important, because you just go out and try stuff out and go, I wonder how the world works this way, or I wonder what that is. And the whole idea of basic research is you have a kind of a hunch, but you're not doing something for a practical outcome. You're just trying to explore how things work and understand the world a little bit better. And we were also talking to Adam Kucharski about, you know, what objective truth is and whether or not you can trust anyone. Because really, everything I know, I've learned from somebody else, and I've just trusted them that it's true. When you think about it, it's kind of crazy. Almost everything you know, you haven't observed yourself. You've just had someone tell you that that's what's happened, and then you believe them. And someone says, this is Paul. Paul says, I don't trust anyone except myself, and that's the only way to operate. Well, Paul, that's not true. You have trusted your mobile operator to get this text to us. You've trusted a mobile operator to take money out of your account. You've trusted people to call you by your name. There's a million different things that you trust. So I think in principle what you're saying is you're not very trustworthy, but we cannot operate in the working world without some level of trust. That's it from us in this week's podcast. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Gavin, Hugo da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.